could be fine, and then to be in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a special Down East edition of Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you'll hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina. On today's special show, I'll be reading excerpts from An Outer Banks Reader, selected and edited by David Stick. Contact Giovanni da Verrazzano, 1524. 2 decades after Amerigo Vespucci suggested that Columbus had found a new world, no one knew its true extent. So in January 1524, King Francis I of France sent the Florentine navigator Giovanni da Verrazzano west in search of a middle latitude route to the Orient. 2 months out, Verrazzano met an obstacle of new land that he reckoned almost larger than Asia. After exploring the vicinity of Cape Fear, he sailed south, then north, confident of finding some strait to get through to the Eastern Ocean. On the Feast of the Annunciation, he anchored at a remarkable place. We called it Annunciata from the day of arrival, and found there an isthmus, 1 mile wide and about 200 miles long, in which we could see the eastern sea from the ship, halfway between west and north. We sailed along this isthmus, hoping all the time to find some strait where land might end to the north, and we could reach those blessed shores of Cathay. He hoped in vain. The supposed isthmus was part of the Outer Banks, evidently between Capes Lookout and Hatteras. The sea? Pamlico Sound. Cartographers drew these features for years, however, inspiring sailors to seek a way to the Pacific through the imaginary Sea of Verrazzano. The following excerpt of Verrazzano's report to the king is the oldest known record of a meeting between Europeans and natives of the Outer Banks. We continued to follow the coast, which we found veered to the east. All along it we saw great fires because of the numerous inhabitants. We anchored off the shore, since there was no harbor, and because we needed water, we sent the small boat ashore with 25 men. The sea along the coast was churned up by enormous waves because of the open beach, and so it was impossible to put anyone ashore without endangering the boat. We saw many people on the beach making various friendly signs and beckoning us ashore, and there I saw a magnificent deed, as your majesty will hear. We sent one of our young sailors swimming ashore to take the people some trinkets, such as little bells, mirrors, and other trifles, and when he came within 4 fathoms of them, he threw them the goods and tried to turn back, but he was so tossed about by the waves that he was carried up on the beach, half dead. Seeing this, the native people immediately ran up. They took him by the head, the legs, and arms, and carried him some distance away. Whereupon the youth, realizing he was being carried away like this, was seized with terror and began to utter loud cries. They answered him in their language to show him he should not be afraid. Then they placed him on the ground in the sun at the foot of a small hill and made gestures of great admiration, looking at the whiteness of his flesh and examining him from head to foot. They took off his shirt and shoes and hose, leaving him naked, then made a huge fire next to him, placing him near the heat. When the sailors in the boat saw this, they were filled with terror, as always when something new occurs, and thought the people wanted to roast him for food. After remaining with them for a while, he regained his strength, and showed them by signs that he wanted to return to the ship. With the greatest kindness, they accompanied him to the sea, holding him close and embracing him, and then, to reassure him, they withdrew to a high hill and stood watching him until he was in the boat. Traffic with the Savages. Arthur Barlow, 1584. John and Sebastian Cabot explored Newfoundland and vicinity under the English flag in the late 1490s, but England did not press a claim until 1577, when Queen Elizabeth I permitted Sir Humphrey Gilbert to investigate anew. After Gilbert disappeared on a second voyage in 1583, she reserved Newfoundland for the crown, but gave his younger half-brother, Walter Raleigh, a patent of discovery for the remaining parts of North America, quote, not actually possessed of any Christian prince and inhabited by Christian people. Raleigh quickly dispatched Philip Amadas and Arthur Barlow in two small ships to reconnoiter his huge grant. They reached the neighborhood of Cape Fear on July 4, 1584, and, according to Barlow, coasted north 120 English miles until they found a promising inlet. On July 13th, they entered it, not without some difficulty, and took possession of the territory in the name of the Queen. 2 days later, they had their first dealings with her unwitting new subjects. The following excerpt of Barlow's account was simplified from the third edition of Richard Hakluyt's Principal Navigations. The third day we espied one small boat rowing towards us, having in it three persons. This boat came to the island side, four harquebus shot from our ships, and there two of the people remaining, the third came along the shore side towards us, and we, being then all within board, he walked up and down upon the point of land next unto us. Then the master and the pilot of the admiral, Simon Ferdinando, and Captain Philip Amadas, myself, and others, rowed to the land, whose coming this fellow attended, never making any show of fear or doubt. And after he had spoken of many things, not understood by us, we brought him with his own good liking aboard the ships, and gave him his shirt, and hat, and some other things, and made him taste of our wine, and our meat, which he liked very well. After having reviewed both barks, he departed, and went to his own boat again, which he had left in a little cove or creek adjoining. As soon as he was two bowshot into the water, he fell to fishing, and in less than half an hour he had laden his boat as deep as it could swim, with which he came again to the point of the land, and there he divided his fish into two parts, pointing one part to the ship and the other to the pinnace, which, after he had, as much as he might, requited the former benefits received, departed out of our sight. The next day there came unto us divers boats, and in one of them the king's brother, accompanied with 40 or 50 men, very handsomely and goodly people, and in their behavior as mannerly and civil as any of Europe. His name was Granjanameo, and the king is called Wingina, the country Winjandakoa. The manner of his coming was in this sort. He left his boats altogether as the first man did, a little from the ships by the shore, and came along to the place over against the ships, followed with 40 men. When he came to the place, his servants spread a long mat upon the ground, upon which he sat down, and at the other end of the mat, four others of his company did the like. The rest of his men stood round about him, somewhat afar off. When we came to the shore to him with our weapons, he never moved from his place, nor any of the other four, nor never mistrusted any harm to be offered from us. But, sitting still, he beckoned us to come and sit by him, which we performed. And, being set, he made all signs of joy and welcome, striking on his head and his breast, and afterward on ours, to show we were all one, smiling and making show the best he could of all love and familiarity. After he had made a long speech unto us, we presented him with divers things, which he received very joyfully and thankfully. After they had been divers times aboard our ships, myself, with seven more, went 20 mile into the river that runneth toward the city of Skycoac, and the evening following we came to an island, which they call Roanoke, distant from the harbor by which we entered, 7 leagues, and at the north end thereof was a village of 9 houses, built of cedar, and fortified round about with sharp trees, to keep out their enemies, and the entrance unto it made like a turnpike very artificially. When we came towards it, standing near unto the water's side, the wife of Granjanameo, the king's brother, came running out to meet us, very cheerfully and friendly. Her husband was not then in the village. Some of her people she commanded to draw our boat on shore for the beating of the billow. others she appointed to carry us on their backs to the dry ground, and others to bring our oars into the house, for fear of stealing. When we were come into the utter room, having 5 rooms in her house, she caused us to sit down by a great fire, and took off our clothes and washed them, and dried them again. Some of the women plucked off our stockings and washed them, some washed our feet in warm water, and she herself took great pains to see all things ordered in the best manner she could, making great haste to dress some meat for us to eat. After we had thus dried ourselves, she brought us into the inner room, where she set on the board standing along the house some wheat like frumenty, sodden venison and roasted, fish sodden, boiled and roasted, melons, raw and sodden, roots of divers kinds, and divers fruits. Their drink is commonly water, but while the grape lasteth, they drink wine, and, for want of casks to keep it, all the year after, they drink water. But it is sodden with ginger in it, and black cinnamon, and sometimes sassafras, and divers other wholesome and medicinable herbs and trees. We were entertained with all love and kindness, and with as much bounty, after their manner, as they could possibly devise. We found the people most gentle, loving, and faithful, void of all guile and treason, and such as live after the manner of the golden age. While we were at meat, there came in at the gates 2 or 3 men with their bows and arrows from hunting, whom we espied. We began to look towards one another, and offered to reach our weapons. But as soon as she espied our mistrust, she was very much moved, and caused some of her men to run out and take away their bows and arrows and break them, and withal beat the poor fellows out of the gate again. When we departed in the evening, and would not tarry all night, she was very sorry, and gave us into our boat our supper half-dressed, pots and all, and brought us to our boat's side, in which we lay all night, removing the same a pretty distance from the shore. She, perceiving our jealousy, was much grieved, and sent divers men and 30 women to sit all night on the bank side by us, and sent us into our boats 5 mats to cover us from the rain, using very many words to entreat us to rest in their houses. But because we were few men, and if we had miscarried, the voyage had been in very great danger, we durst not adventure anything, although there was no cause for doubt, for a more kind and loving people there cannot be found in the world, as far as we have hitherto had trial. Market Gunning, H. H. Brimley, 1884. Over a period of more than half a century, zoologist Herbert H. Brimley made numerous visits to Currituck County, ever on the lookout for new or better wildfowl specimens for the exhibits he prepared for the State Museum in Raleigh. His observations appeared in many articles and several books, including the posthumous compilation A North Carolina Naturalist, from which the following selection was taken. My first direct knowledge of Currituck Sound was in February 1884. Reaching Currituck was not easy in those days, as that section of the state then possessed no railway facilities. By rail to Norfolk was the first lap, thence by steamer up the Elizabeth River, through the Albemarle and Chesapeake Canal and North River into Currituck Sound. The canal was again entered at the south end of Coinjock Bay, my getting-off place being the settlement of Coinjock. From there, across Church Island, to the Midyet place on the Sound, was by oxcart. My business there was to collect and preserve specimens of waterfowl for exhibition purposes at the State Exposition that was to be held during the whole of the following October at the old State Fairgrounds near Raleigh. My headquarters being situated about the center of the market hunting industry, most of the specimens secured were purchased from the professional gunners. But I did some personal collecting, as on bluebird days the market hunters would not bother to go out, when I would secure the loan of a battery and pick up a few specimens that way. The gas boat was unknown in those days, all boat movement being by sail or manpower. The sailboats were canoes roomy enough to carry 5 or 6 head of cattle, or horses, and they were used by the duck hunters in carrying their batteries to and from the shooting grounds, with the stand of decoys occupying 1 or more skiffs and towed by the canoe. These crafts were built up of three dugout pieces doweled together, the inside framing assisting in fastening the three units to tight, waterproof joints. They were heavy, but safe and seaworthy, their sail plan being the more or less standardized sprit sail and jib rig, perhaps the most handy and convenient rig ever used on a comparatively small sailboat. The skiffs were never rowed or paddled, as the shallow waters of the Sound made poling a much more efficient method of propulsion. There were ducks and geese on the Sound in those days. One afternoon I tried to count, roughly, the number of Canada geese in a straggling line of flocks that was crossing Church's Island for their night's resting place in Coinjock Bay. My estimate was well above the 10,000 mark, and that flight represented only a small part of the myriads frequenting the Sound both north and south from my viewpoint. My host, Uncle Ned Midyette, owned four batteries and employed the gunners to man them, two men constituting the crew of each. He also employed a boy to do odd jobs around the house, whose first duty every morning was, as soon as light enough to distinguish objects, take his gun and inspect several miles of shoreline to pick up crippled ducks that had swum ashore during the night, it being a well-known habit of ducks to come ashore when wounded. The following are the approximate prices the gunners were getting for their fowl, cash on the spot by the regular buyers, all prices per pair, except as otherwise noted. Canvasback, $1. Redhead, 50 cents. Common duck, 30 cents. Small ducks, as teal, ruddy, bufflehead, etc., 25 cents, with four ducks constituting a pair. Canada geese brought 50 cents each. At that time, of course, no refrigeration facilities were available, though a small amount of icing may have been done. The usual method, however, was to allow the fowl to hang up overnight to cool off, they being packed in barrels the next morning and shipped to Norfolk by steamer. Batteries have been outlawed for a number of years now, and it may be a matter of interest, particularly to the younger generation, to submit a description of an old-time battery and its outfit as used on Currituck Sound in the 1880s. Another name for the device was sink box, which is far more descriptive than the name commonly used, which means hardly anything in this connection. The box itself was a coffin-shaped affair, of such dimensions as to afford a fairly close fit, both in length and width, for an average-sized man lying on his back, its depth being such that no part of the occupant could be seen when the box was viewed from the side. When in use, a small pillow or cushion raised the head until the eyes were on a level with the rims of the box. At this same level, a rigid deck some 3 feet wide was attached on all four sides and sloping slightly down towards the water, with flexible floating wings attached to all sides of the fixed deck, and with a particularly long extension at the head end. These wings, rising and falling with the motion of the surface water, tended to keep it from running up the fixed deck and so into the box. An added precaution against this most uncomfortable possibility consisted of strips of sheet lead an inch or two wide that were tacked along their inner edges, so that they could be turned slightly by their outer edges whenever the surface became rough enough to warrant such a procedure. When finished, the whole upper surface of the complete battery was painted a flat slaty gray, which made it almost invisible a short distance away. At its best, a battery was always a clumsy affair and awkward to handle, and setting one out and taking it up again on a cold, windy day was no job for weaklings. It was securely anchored by the head, with a dragging anchor of lighter weight out over the tail end, the latter to prevent too much swinging sidewise. Possibly 150 decoys was about an average stand for a single battery. I've seen much larger stands used as well as many not so large. The best arrangement of the decoys is with the bulk of the decoys concentrated about at right angles to the box on the left side of the man lying therein. For a left-handed gunner, the arrangement would be reversed. The remainder of the decoys should gradually taper off in width and be more widely scattered downwind from the larger concentration near the battery. Movable ballast was used to sink the battery to its most effective level in the water, the ballast consisting of cast iron decoys weighing about 25 pounds each. The number of iron ducks used was variable, perhaps 10 being an average. They were painted in keeping with the wooden decoys, and each iron decoy was fastened with a stout line to one of its wooden brethren, so that if the weather should turn rough enough to threaten water in the box, some of the iron ducts could be slid overboard and thus raise the battery to a safer level. The professional gunners, and some experienced amateurs, would take two guns with them in the box. The 32-inch barrels made it easier to rest the muzzles on the footboard, which should always be done for reasons of safety. The guns usually used by the market gunners were double-barreled 10-gauge weapons with 32-inch barrels and hammers. Automatics and repeaters came along at a later date. I have tried this method of shooting on a number of occasions, but have nearly always had better shooting from a blind, though the battery was a deadly method of taking waterfowl when practiced by experienced professionals. There is a Chesapeake Bay record of more than 500 ducks killed in one day's shooting by a market hunter using two guns in his battery. On Currituck, bags of 100 a day from a battery were not rare enough to get one's name in the paper. A now-deceased friend of mine, a crack shot on ducks, substituting for a market hunter at his request, once averaged about 130 a day for three successive days, and that was well within the present century. It goes almost without saying that a majority of the inhabitants of the shores of the Sound made most of their winter's income directly or indirectly from the commercial hunting of waterfowl. The opening of Oregon and Hatteras Inlets. William L. Welch, 1846. The inlets that breach the Outer Banks are forever changing in size, shape, and location. Major changes usually occur during tempests such as hurricanes, when the storm surge floods the low-lying islands, often causing new inlets to open and old ones to close. Most storm-bred inlets remain open only a short time, but some, like the pair created by the hurricane of September 7th to 8th, 1846, last for decades, even centuries. One of that pair, Oregon Inlet, started as two small channels opening from sound to sea, one of which soon closed while the other widened and deepened to become Oregon Inlet. Hatteras Inlet was initially the more significant of the 1846 inlets. By 1862, it was large enough and stable enough to accommodate a large federal fleet en route to Roanoke Island. While stationed at Hatteras in the summer of 1864, William L. Welch heard some history of the inlet from Redding R. Quidley, a local pilot. It was almost 20 years later, however, before Welch set out to learn more about the circumstances of its opening and began writing to Quidley. These selections from their correspondence are taken from the Bulletin of the Essex Institute. Both inlets have remained open ever since, and are at this writing the northernmost inlets on the North Carolina coast. The letter of Mr. Quidley, received in April through Colonel Whitford and Governor Jarvis, was dated at Hatteras Inlet, North Carolina, April 7, 1884. It says, "I will say in regard to your request that Hatteras Inlet was cut out by a heavy gale, a violent storm on the 7th of September at night, 1846. The first vessel that passed through into Pamlico Sound was the schooner Asher C. Havens, on the 5th day of February, 1847, Captain David Barrett, commander. I was pilot of said schooner, conducted her through all safe. No other vessel had ever passed through the inlet. The first vessel that ever crossed over the bar of Hatteras Inlet was in January, 1847. I was then a licensed pilot for Ocracoke Inlet. Got on board to pilot the schooner into Ocracoke. Wind came ahead. I went into Hatteras Inlet for harbor, stayed all night, went out next morning, and went into Ocracoke. I cannot give any correct report what time the first vessel passed out. It was not long after the first passed through. The second vessel passed through about 2 weeks after the first. It was a small steamer bound through Core Sound. I piloted it through." In another letter, Mr. Quidley says, "I was licensed to pilot at Ocracoke Inlet in 1831. I then lived at Hatteras, and when I piloted a vessel in at Ocracoke, which very often would be 2, 3, or 4 a week, and walked home to Hatteras, there was nothing to cause me or anyone to have any idea that there would be an inlet there. Sooner than any other part of the beach, there was no water passed over the place except in those heavy easterly gales, when, as a general thing, it passes over nearly all our beach, from Hatteras to Ocracoke. The day the inlet was cut out, there were several families living where the inlet is now, but to their great surprise, in the morning they saw the sea and sound connected together, and the live oaks washing up by the roots and tumbling into the ocean. I was well acquainted with the growth of the land where the inlet now is. I lived with my brother where the inlet is now. I have worked with him cutting wood and chopping yaupon, where now I have no doubt there's 3 or 4 fathoms of water. The growth was live oak principally, did not grow tall, but large trunks and spreading limbs. I had an old uncle lived about where the inlet is, who had a fine fig orchard and many peach trees on his lot, with fine potato patch and garden. Again, Mr. Quidley writes, "Since I wrote you last, I have conversed with the 2 oldest men living on this portion of the banks. One is in his 75th year, the other in his 72nd, both born and raised where the inlet is now. John Austin, the eldest, says he remembers his grandfather very well. He says he has heard the old gentleman say there was an inlet about 6 miles southwest of where the inlet is now. He states that the old man said there was an English vessel, a ship, ran on the bar of said inlet, and was lost, and the wreck sanded up, and the beach made down to it, and finally closed up the inlet. Mr. Austin's grandfather's name was Styron, died March 7, 1825, aged 86 years. The other man I talked with was William Balance. He says his father died in 1826, 68 years old. He says he heard his father say that he had seen a piece of wreck standing up, right at or near the place that Austin speaks of as being the place where the inlet was, and had been told by older people that it was the stern post of the vessel that closed up the inlet. This place that they speak of is about 5 or 6 miles from this inlet we have now, between 2 points now known as Shingle Creek and Quake Hammock." And finally, in a letter dated September 29, 1884, he says, "The Shingle Creek is about 5 miles from Hatteras Inlet, is 40 or 50 yards wide, makes up through a portion of marsh and a low growth of woods or bushes to the beach, but not through the beach, and a little to the northeast of it there is another creek, about like the one just named, called the Old Inlet Creek, which I think might take its name from being somewhere near where the inlet was. The Great Swash is a level place of beach, nothing growing on it but some grass or sedge next to the sound side, and extends about 1 mile to the next growth of woods called Knoll. The Quake Hammock is a small clump of woods lying between Shingle Creek and Great Swash. I cannot give the exact time that vessels left off passing through Ocracoke. I was one of the first commissioners of navigation appointed for Hatteras Inlet, I think in 1852. There has been but very little passing through Ocracoke Inlet since 1855. There is no vessel passed through there now, except perchance that a vessel goes in case of distress of weather or head winds and draws light draft of water, 4 or 5 feet. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.